bro.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Wall Street is steadying its nerves, keeping its cool this morning. The Dow Jones has opened significantly up, the Nasdaq only moderately down. Over the weekend, Asian markets took their cue from Friday's panic on Wall Street to plunge in a major way. The Hong Kong stock market fell almost 9%. Singapore lost almost 9%. In Europe, the damage was almost as bad. From London to Zurich, markets were down between 3 and 4%. The funny thing is, through the several serious tremors of the late 90s, American investors came back unshaken, sustaining the Dow Jones average at more than 11,000 points even last week. So now we will see what this old bull market is made of, how believable the promise of a technological transformation of our world is, how sturdy a bubble this new economy really is. Connection listeners, are you shopping for bargains this morning, or are you looking for exit signs? Are you feeling a lot less wealthy than you did a week ago? Or are we all getting used to this roller coaster boom and bust in paper profits, after all, and what for most of us are just rumors of monster money? Our phone is 1-800-423-8255. Friday afternoon, the wise guys were saying that the internet game was over. Now you wonder, is the panic over? We're re-canvassing the wise guys this hour. Richard Babson is in our studio of the Babson United Market Newsletter. Dave Kansas of Street.com is on the line from New York. And the forecaster, Alan Sinai of Primark Decision Economics. Also, Ken Huebner, portfolio chief at Capital Growth Management, an investment fund in Boston. 1-800-423-8255. We're all experts on this market. Dave Kansas in New York, what is happening at this moment?
Right now, the market is actually snapping back. It was down, the Nasdaq was down something like more than 90 right out of the open, and now it's up more than 90, 180-point swing in 35 minutes. So it's pretty volatile.
And what about the Dow Jones, which was down 600 and some points on Friday?
It's up a little bit. It seems that the market is a little bit this morning, but it's still very volatile.
What does it tell you?
I think that a lot of people in this market historically have looked for bottoms, tried to buy the dips, and that mentality is going to be difficult to break. So you see a lot of selling last week, and people take the weekend and they think, maybe this is another chance to buy in the dips. And so they're digging in a little bit this morning, trying to find some seeming bargains. And that pattern is not going to go away very easily. Markets are down pretty sharply from their highs.
What does it mean that New York is not going the way of Hong Kong or London?
Well, I think they were reacting more to Friday and last week in the news that surrounded the selling, especially on Friday, more than doing anything additive. I think they were looking at what happened Friday and deciding that things looked very bad and then selling. I think what will be interesting to see is how those markets react this overnight, but there's still a long way to go in today's session. I think, you know, the Nasdaq, like I said, has moved in 180-point-plus range already today, and there's no telling where things are going to go. It's very active. And
why should the American atmosphere and mood and cue and leadership role be different from investors, you know, in Asia and Europe?
Why should...
What makes the American atmosphere different?
Well, I mean, why are we bouncing back this morning?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I think that the American market is its own beast, so to speak. It very rarely reacts to what's happening overseas, and it's reacting more to what people are looking at here. And I think what you have is a situation where the major indexes went down very dramatically, lost a lot of money, and some people are trying to come in and buy here. And I don't think they're as concerned with what happened in, say, Asia as they are concerned with what is happening this morning in the U.S., trying to see if there is a chance to put in a bottom right here. But I think, you know, only 50 minutes into the trading day, it's hard to gauge whether or not the positive numbers we see right now are for real.
Richard Babson, in our studio, what do you think is going on here?
Well, I think that the Wall Street market's always taken the lead. Even back in 87 when you watched what happened there, as it went around the globe, other markets took their lead from the U.S. market. You did see some stabilizing in European markets this morning, not the same type of drop-off that you had in Japan, but Japan's a very interesting beast. We've said for quite some time that they might need another couple of years of type of federal fiscal spending that they had this last year to get themselves out of their asset depression.
And yet people are worried that we are now entering what Japan has been wallowing in through the 90s.
Well, we are what I like to call running up our own heartbreak hill of rising interest rates. The marathon analogy, I think, is very apt today, especially. And I don't think we're going to hit the wall. I think that there's a lot of speed left in the economy.
Be very specific about what's happening in technology. I mean, the monster boom in NASDAQ and the crash is all about technology. It's all about the general expectations decided that we're entering a wonderfully brave new world, new investment climate, new everything. Are we or aren't we?
Well, the Internet revolution is here to stay. What you do have is a difference in terms of assets. You have knowledge-based assets. It could be a piece of software, which over the Internet can be delivered to everybody simultaneously, versus a rival asset like an airplane, which can only go from Boston to Chicago or from Boston to Dallas. So you have the opportunity for a lot more leverage in what's involved in the new economy, and that's what's made it look so attractive, is that you can have this possibility for explosive revenue growth, and if you get a small margin on that explosive revenue growth, then you have something that's very attractive.
Well, I hate to reduce it all to that word bubble, but it comes back to that. Is the new economy a myth and a bubble, or is it, as we feel intuitively, a new millennium, new century, new everything, and still an enormous opportunity?
Well, I like to remind people that it's not a difference between the new economy and the old economy. It really is just one economy, that you don't have a differentiation like you used to between agriculture and the Industrial Revolution. Two-thirds of the economy is already services. So what you're seeing happening is, in a way, a commoditization of certain services, particularly something like brokerage, which now can be sold over the Internet, or you can still execute through your broker on Main Street or Wall Street.
Put that in the context of the sell-off of NASDAQ technology stocks last week.
Well, there certainly was a lot of expectation built into the market, and just as you had with the biotechnology boom back in the 70s, a lot of people had fond expectations. What's happened is that we have more realistic expectations today.
Dave Kansas, I wonder what you think is the prospect in technology stocks. I mean, people say they say it's over, or they say, come on, it's just a further weeding of the dot-coms, and they're going to have to be productive. They're going to have to be better. They can't simply have a new, you know, web address and get money. What's the prospect for technology stocks in general?
I think technology is a very vast area. You have everything from very strong established companies like a Cisco Systems with incredibly powerful market positions, and then you have a lot of these younger dot-coms, especially in the consumer space at the other end of the spectrum. And I think that in the near term, technology stocks that are established, so-called older technology stocks, are going to be much more attractive for investors. I think a lot of the speculation has left the marketplace. A lot of people feel very burned. They've lost a lot of money, and it's going to be harder for some of the untested dot-coms, so to speak, to come back very quickly. I think the tone is going to return to the technology stocks that are more household names.
For example?
Like Microsoft, or, I mean, even they've got some legal issues, or Intel. I mean, some of these stocks...
Some legal issues.
that's a euphemism, isn't it? I think it's this technology revolution that is occurring, and like Richard says, it goes across all of the economy, is not going to stop because of a week of bad trading. I think that people are recalibrating some of their expectations, but technology is going to remain a very vital part, not only of the U.S. economy, but of the global economy. And I think people who are looking longer term need to be invested in that area.
John Spooner is on the line, Senior Vice President at Salomon Smith Barney, and he's the author of the book, Do You Want to Make Money or Would You Rather Fool Around? John Spooner, welcome. Let's assume we'd like to make some money. What kinds of technology stocks would you be shopping for? What Which ones would you be getting rid of?
Well, let's talk about in general for a second rather than individuals, because what do you do in a panic atmosphere or a really tumultuous atmosphere? Number one, I never care what the market's doing. It's how our stocks are doing, how your fund is doing. That's what the key is. So forget the market for a second. It's an atmosphere where you have to be disciplined, Christopher. And by disciplined, I say you have to figure out what are your five favorites and what are you willing to pay for them? Because we're surrounded by information overload and the talking heads, if you will. And you have to focus on what do I believe in and what do I think is going to be right for the future. So whatever I'm doing today is focused on where do I want to be 2 years from now, not a week from now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So when I say focus on what your five favorites might be, whether it's so-called old economy, although I hate to use that term, or technology, and there are bargains perhaps all over the lot, not just in technology. For instance, a month ago, the regional banks were probably the cheapest asset in America. They had been cut by 50 or 60%. Xerox the same, Coke the same, Gillette the same. You know, so you can look at old quality names, not just technology. But if it were pure tech, I'd say you look at companies that are going to supply the net and service the net, and this really would be the telecommunications area. So WorldCom, MCI, even AT&T, Lucent, if you can, AOL, if you can buy them at the right prices. So what I suggest in this volatility is if something was 100 and now it's 70, put an order in to buy your favorites at 60. And leave the orders in and let the market watch it for you. Don't chase any rallies.
But, John, just to say, what are your five favorites?
Yeah.
Sounds like advice to get out of novelty, get out of the big dreams and back to, if not GE, back to the big name players. That's very conservative advice.
Well, I think conservative, but also value oriented. And I think this has served investors well for 100 years because what's happened. See, we became the national sport, particularly in the last 8, 9, or 10 months. And wherever you went, people came back from vacation this winter and reported to me and said, no one's talking about their businesses. All they're talking about is the stock market. So greed really gained the upper hand. And this is not a real business, the business of finance. It's a business of emotion. And fear and greed calls the tune. And when greed is so obvious, you know there's going to be a reckoning.
What do you take to be the atmosphere this morning, John Spooner?
The atmosphere this morning seems to be that some bargain hunting, fairly orderly, no panic, but all the action in the markets in recent times have taken place in the last hour. So it's like, let's throw the ball around for a while, get warmed up until 3 o'clock, and that's when the real fun starts.
John Spooner, we'll throw the ball around here, too. Thank you for tossing it with us. John Spooner.
Thank you, Christopher.
Author of Do You Want to Make Money or Would You Rather Fool Around? 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK makes the pre-panic or post-panic Wall Street connection. 1-800-423-8255. Jack is on the line.
Hi.
Welcome, Jack.
The speaker before mentioned buy at the right price. And my question is, of course, that's the magic thing, is what is the right price? My specific question is, they mentioned some solid stocks like Oracle, Cisco, whatever. Looking at them today, even at their low price now, they're still valued at PEs of like 100, about 100, which about 5, 7 years ago would be considered crazy. So the issue of what the right price is, depends in my mind on which valuation model you're using, like a 10-year ago solid analytic one or something today that's relative to yesterday's looks good, but relative to 10 years ago looks crazy. What is the right valuation model?
Richard Babson, what is it?
Usually nowadays people are looking at discounted cash flows, the expected cash flows that you're seeing in the future discounted to the present rate. And of course that means you have to make assumptions about what you think is going to happen with the rate of inflation as well as the interest rate as a result. What you've had recently with the great economic boom that we've had going on since 1991 is a compounding that's taken place. It's sort of that old question, would you like to get 30% in 1 year or 1% over 30 years? That type of compounded growth. You do have companies like Cisco, for instance, which is a very good company. It's making some of the picks and shovels of for Internet service providers. And it has some great dynamic prospects for growth, not only here but abroad. There's no final answer.
Is there any new rule post-weekend on price-earnings ratios?
It's certainly something to look at in terms of a benchmark, but there are certain industries, for instance, in the knowledge base industry, where price-to-earnings ratios don't quite work.
Jack, hope that does it. 1-800-423-8255. Jake is on the line.
Hello.
Hello, Chris. Jake. Welcome.
Chris, how are you?
Good.
Chris, you have a wonderful program. I've almost gotten fired for listening to you.
That's an honorable cause.
Huh?
That's an honorable reason to be fired.
Well,
nothing to be ashamed of.
I want to say this. I have a system completely different from everybody else and works every time for me. Let me tell you what we just did. My wife sold, just before the NASDAQ crash, she sold the entire stock about March the 10th, I think it was. And her stock had been at 49, and she sold at 222. The stock went to 240. And she sold, and the next day that stock is now $100 below its peak. What we tend to do is our philosophy is quite different. We don't listen to all these experts here. We tend to hold growing cash. When the market is extremely crazy like it's been, we stay in cash. We wait for opportunities. Now, volatility is where we make our money. And anyway, in this case, our 401ks are on cash position, most of them, waiting for opportunities. What we're going to do is we're going to take my wife's profits and put part of it down at the 3,000 level. When this NASDAQ gets the support level, we're going to put some of it there in our favorite stocks, the ones that have gone up, actually, during this period, the real strong ones. They're watching which ones are doing that.
Jake, I want to know what cued your wife to sell out at 222.
Because I jumped on her and I said, buying a stock is two decisions, not just when to buy, but when to sell.
Right.
And I said, let's not get greedy. You got it at 49. It's now 222. When are you going to stop? You know, I mean, this is ridiculous. And everything looks shaky. It's a gut instinct from watching the market for 30 years. And sell. I said, we're 60 or 65. She's 57. We don't have years to hold. Okay, Chris?
Okay.
We can't do that. They all say buy and hold. That's ridiculous.
Listen to your gut, Jake, and thank you for sharing it with us. 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about steady nerves on Wall Street so far today. Though, as John Spooner said, the action in these markets has been between 3 o'clock and closing. 1-800-423-8255. Is Friday's panic over? 1-800-423-TALK. Ken Huebner joins us by phone. He's a portfolio manager for Capital Growth Management in Boston. Ken Huebner, you were never completely sold on the technology stock idea. Do you see chickens coming home to roost here?
I do. I bring the bias, having done this for 30 years and seen valuation excesses and valuation opportunities. And I think you have to look at the starting point of this decline. The NASDAQ index in the summer of 1999 ran up hugely through the end of February. And we've pulled back somewhat from where it was. But I think we have a lot of room to the downside in a lot of NASDAQ stocks. The price-earnings ratio of the NASDAQ as of this morning is 41 times earnings. That's very high. And I think that the thing that drove the stocks to the extreme levels that they got to was just enthusiasm and buying both in the public and in the mutual fund industry. And it's the biggest speculative binge I've ever seen in my career. I think where you have the most vulnerability is in the companies that don't have earnings or even now are selling over 50 times earnings. There are companies in the NASDAQ that are, I would call it, traditional companies, that I wouldn't think that's, you know, they may be a little expensive. I wouldn't run out and sell them. But I think where you had the extreme events, and I call extreme event is a company's in excess of 80 times earnings.
Yes.
When you take something from 250 times earnings down to 150 times earnings, that's not a bargain. And so I think you've got to look carefully at your portfolio and sell these companies that, even though they were down a lot last week, still have a huge valuation excess embedded in them.
Wouldn't people say, Ken Huebner, though, you say there's room for a lot of those NASDAQ stocks yet to fall. You'd have to concede you missed a lot of room for them to grow, did you not?
Well, you know, that's an interesting point. That's the interesting question of the time horizon you use. Clearly, I wasn't when they got over 50 times earnings. I wasn't there. I missed the move up. Hmm. So the real question is, do these stratospheric valuations have validity or not? And if they, you know, and if that's the case, the same thing that caused me to miss them will cause me to catch what some people might think is a buying opportunity. I think the key question is, do valuations matter? Do the long-term historical benchmarks by which we valued stocks have validity? I believe they do. If you don't think, I mean, if you want to, I believe that price to sales is not something to use as a valuation benchmark. I have seen when valuation excesses build. I remember it in the oil exploration and natural gas stocks in the, around 1979 and 80 when we had a bubble there. First thing you know, people said, well, you can't use price earnings ratios anymore. We use price to cash flow.
Hmm.
This reminds me of a process that we've seen at other peaks.
Well,
Richard Babson.
With the price, with the oil scenario that you're talking about there with oil stocks, a lot of that was also driven by tax considerations. It's interesting that both you and a previous caller, in terms of talking about a strategy, it's important to have a strategy and stick to it. In terms of the price to earnings ratio, as I mentioned before, you have such people like Baruch Lev down in New York who are talking about the knowledge-based economy. And how some of the leverage on assets, you can't really use a price-to-earnings ratio for that.
Richard Babson, stand by. Ken Huebner, too, you're listening to The Connection. 1-800-423-8255 makes the pre-panic or post-panic Wall Street connection. Dave Kansas, will you just comment on the price-earnings point? I mean, Ken Huebner is saying, in effect, there's no such thing as a bargain in this market at 150 times earnings.
Well, I think he's right that some stocks that are valued at these 150, 200 PEs are extraordinarily expensive, but I think that sometimes there's a mistake made in getting too dogmatic about multiples over time. I mean, historically, multiples have not been a constant. For a long time, people have thought that they should be a constant. I don't think they have been. I think you look at a company like Cisco, you never would have had a chance to own Cisco Systems over the last several years if you would have believed dogmatically in price-to-earnings ratios, yet that's been one of the best stocks in the market over that period of time. So I think you do need to have some discipline, especially in a market like this where things are getting very volatile, but you can't ignore good companies that come back to you as well.
1-800-423-8255 is the connection phone. Andy is on the line.
Hey, Chris, this is definitely a verification that investment has become sport, and I love it. And I've thrown my hat into the ring today. I actually bought some stock. The basic premise I use that if a product or a service is going to make things more convenient for people or more competitive for business, I tend to buy it. So I bought some smaller internet-based stocks this morning on E-Trade, and you know, I feel.
Just a second. Forgive me, Andy. I want to get your principles again. More convenient for people, or
if
more.
If something more convenient for people, or business more competitive, then I tend to look at it as something that people will buy. I mean, one of the things I've really looked at is whether this whole idea of home shopping is going to work over the internet, like companies like that serve around the Boston area that I've heard of, like Home Runs, and I know Peapod hasn't done particularly well lately. But that looks to me as a very interesting opportunity to see how well people respond to a convenience-based service. I invested in a company called Rare Medium this morning that basically services the internet people who are looking to develop websites and become more present on the internet. I looked at their value over time, and it's gone way down, but I see great potential and their ability to grow out of that. I bought some Yahoo, and you know, the other things I haven't bought, even though it's a contradictory to that, is I haven't ever bought any Amazon.com because I don't see them as operating in the real world. I don't see that you can operate a company as flagrantly disrespectful of the profit motive as they have been.
Andy, so, I want to get Ken Huebner's professional review of your instinct here. Thank you.
Well, listening to the commentary there, these home grocery companies have big losses and negative cash flow, too. So I think the thing that makes him worried on Amazon, if he's consistent, he'll be worried about the home grocers, too.
What about this notion that e-tail is over?
Well, once again, I think you have to look at the P&L of the company. I think for companies with substantial negative cash flow, it's over. Now, because let's look at some things here. The first thing is we have a big increase in competition in e-tailing because of basically free money for venture capitalists and the public. Additionally, the bricks and mortar retailers that have expertise in all the forms that these e-tailing companies are coming into have been slow to build their to enter the e-tailing business, but they're coming. Walmart's coming. Other companies are coming. So I think we have a big increase in competition ahead of us detailing, and if you've got negative cash flow now, I think that negative cash flow is probably going to increase over time.
Ken Huebner, when you say free money from investors, you're talking about the sort of the IPO plunges.
Right.
Is that
if you're losing a lot of money and you can sell a stock at a very high price, I call that free money.
Ken Huebner, thank you enormously for joining us. Ken Huebner of Capital Growth Management. We're talking about Wall Street on the morning after Friday's panic. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at Allaire.com.
From Boston University.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. We're talking about the market mood after the Friday panic. The Dow Jones is up this morning. 1-800-423-8255 makes The Connection. 1-800-423-TALK. Alan Sinai joins us, chief global economist and strategist at Primark Decision Economics. He's in New York this morning. Alan, give us the picture in your crystal ball.
Well, we're getting bargain hunting here early in the day in New York. It's to be expected after the collapse on Friday, but I think we're still in the middle of a very big correction, not unexpected. It has some to go yet. Fundamental problem here is too much inflation. The Fed has to keep hiking rates, and down the road that's going to hurt earnings of corporations, and I think we call it the boom-bust scenario, and the stock market is chewing on that, at least fundamentally chewing on it.
Chewing and thinking. What does this opening tell you?
You know, there are values. Whenever you have the kind of decline we have, there are values. And for long-term investors, some money can be put to work. But I don't think there's any real commitment and enthusiasm here on the opening today. From the trading side, they'll kind of wait to see how we do during the day, and if by 2:30 or 3 o'clock it looks pretty good, we'll get some upside trading momentum. But fundamentally, it's the same old thing from history. It's rising inflation, rising interest rates. It's the Fed, and eventually that takes steam out of the economy, hurts corporate earnings, and that will be fully reflected in stock.
But Alan Sana, you've been a believer in general in the new economy. What difference does that make?
I think for a three to five year horizon, believers in the new economy, as I am, would selectively put money to work with that horizon in mind. The new economy companies are what we call high beta companies. That is, their revenue and earnings prospects have a lot of risk around it. And that means when you get a correction like this, those areas like technology are going to decline much more than the general averages. And those who believe in it, as I do, have to live through the volatility and the and the corrections.
Alan Sina, you speak about commitment and enthusiasm. A lot of the important spillover of all that has been in the IPO market, in the sense that, you know, any really bright young thing with a provocative idea can raise money from a venture capitalist. What is this Friday panic and this sense of a correction you're talking about going to do to that sort of seedbed?
It's going to shut it off for a lot of companies and a lot of ideas. Mm-hmm. And dot-com companies that run out of money aren't going to get more money from venture funders. Good ideas, good prospects with more realism than some of the ideas of the past will probably still get funding. Everybody associated with this part of the new economy, where the pricing and the funding and the job growth has been so kind of unbelievably aggressive, is really going to get sobered up by this series of events.
Dave Kansas, I wonder, I know we've got to let you go, but I wonder before you do, if the morning opening is just kind of breezing the horses before the race, what do you expect at 3 o'clock now?
Well, I think as the day rolls forward, I think we're going to see more selling pressure start to come into this market. I think that Alan's right that we're still in the middle of a difficult time. I think even though we are up more than 120 on the Dow and more than 80 on the NASDAQ, I think that as we get closer to 3 o'clock, I think things are going to get a lot more interesting. I wanted to make one quick comment on Alan's reference to private financing and IPOs. I think the public market is definitely getting tougher for financing, but there's still a lot of money sloshing around in the private space, and you just may see more activity in the private space for a while longer than you will see in the public space.
Dave Kansas, thank you.
Thank you very much, Christopher.
Alan Sina, I want to go back to this matter of free money, IPO money. Ken Hebe referred to it as just kind of, mm-hmm. It is the money that that sustains these young companies. If that's gone, a lot of the magic of this millennial moment is gone, too. What do you think?
Well, for now, that part of it is gone, but everyone will just be more careful about the business prospects of business ideas and business plans, and the venture capital people will be more careful about putting money out. So I think, actually, if you step back as kind of a doctor of the scene, I would say it's a healthy development, because this part of what was going on in the new economy, in my view, had gotten too speculative, too frothy, mm-hmm. and was contributing to economic growth and jobs creation in an unjustifiable way. And these kinds of shakeouts, the good side of these kinds of shakeouts, make everyone more realistic, and then fundamentally we go forward on better ground.
Well, I think what you're talking about is where you're going to have to focus, or the IPOs are going to have to focus more on productive capacity as opposed to, gee, we're going to go for the IPO, I got my money, I'm out the door, so long.
1-800-423-8255 makes the market connection after the Friday panic on Wall Street. 1-800-423-8255. Calvin is on the line.
Let's talk about where these people are running with their IPO money. The people who are making the IPO money are the venture capitalists. They're also the ones who are heating up the froth underneath the bubble. It's like so much helium. While the market is crashing, all small investors should let it crash, because finally the VCs, who are basically living on a marketing world, are finally taking a bath. Yeah, the small investor took his bath on Friday, but the large investor, the venture capitalists, those fund managers, are getting slammed now. Now, why do they care? Because it is their job to get the quickest return with the highest investment. They don't care about the small investor. The people who are getting slammed are these e-tailers. Yeah, that's bringing down the overall market, Cisco's and Intel's and whatnot, but they'll bounce back up. But people who really don't make anything, don't create a service, non-techies, direct marketers, those people are out the door. This is healthy, though, for other people who want to get into the market who really have something worth selling.
Who are you rooting for here, Calvin, and what are you going to do with this this moment yourself?
Well, I mean, I'm a technologist myself, so I've been waiting on this. Remember, individuals who have real value, real properties, go to venture capitalists just like other people do. When they go to the venture capitalist, it is the venture capitalist's job not to say, wow, your company's really worth X to them, but to say your company's really worth half of X. Then when they take it out, and they finish, they finance it, the owner of the company really doesn't own it anymore. The venture capitalist does. Then it's his job to present it in a marketing system to the market fast enough so that it will get an IPO pop. That's not value. That's a scam. So I think this is really the small investor being awakened to the scam. Let me tell you, the Internet's not going anywhere, but the scam is over. And I want these people who are supporting VCs and who are supporting Internet holding companies in Massachusetts, who I won't name, to come out of the box. I spoke with a large...
Wait, now. Who are these people you're not naming?
Well, I can't do that, man, because, you know, now I get a bad name in the industry. But but let me say this.
Wait a second. You're talking to – I'm an investor so small, I'm not even visible to the naked eye. What should I be doing in this market?
Well, let me say this to you. When you look at a holding company like CMGI, and you look at them, they lost 70% of their value by Saturday. I was at a conference, a technology conference, two Saturdays ahead of that, in which I spoke with that gentleman and another gentleman who run the company and said, look, you've got to stop scamming people with these direct marketing fake e-tail properties. You can get whatever you want at Amazon at the store. It takes you less time to get in your car than it does to boot up your computer. Why is Amazon going to win? Only by creating a lower markup on the product, but that's not any real value. Eventually, they die too. So what you want to look for is people who are making real technology or creating real service or creating real products. If they ain't making nothing, then it's a marketing scam. Why else do you see all of these new companies come out and spend 90% of their startup money or their IPO money on marketing? Because when you're lying, you need to market. But when you're good, you build it, they'll come.
Calvin, you're wonderful. I'm going to do everything you say, every single thing. Thank you. 1-800-423-8255. Richard Babson, Alan Sina, do you want to...
There's a lot of truth in what the gentleman said. It's the money game. It's the same old thing that's going on from time immemorial. And for the individual investor, you got to see through that. The individual investor is kind of swung along on the momentum and the heady profits that they have made. And what you do if you're not sure about a company is you simply sit on the money, keep it in cash while this is going on. You can earn a decent return. At least you have the principal and make sure that whatever you invest in, either the managers who run the money will be doing the work for you or you do the work. There's a real product, real service, and a real prospect of earnings in what you invest in.
Say, what's also
Richard
true,
Bethan,
though, in terms of the venture capital environment is that it's those same venture capital fund operators that's really helped create the entrepreneurialism that we've seen probably wouldn't have something with the burgeoning of the Internet that we've seen so far in terms of how productivity has come to play or the growth in employment that we've had without the type of capital markets that we have, and VC and private equity placement is certainly a very large part of that.
1-800-423-8255. Dan is on the line.
Hello. I find it interesting. Normally I listen to sports talk radio, but my first call in is actually on the stock market.
So that's great. It's all sports talk now, Dan.
It suggests something about the number of people who participate in the stock market as a game, I guess. In any event, what I'm interested about is one of the gentlemen mentioned from a stock valuation standpoint using cash flow. And the concern I have after working in the high-tech industry is that I think that there's very little likelihood that somebody who, you know, makes a few bets on stocks that are trading at 100 times earnings is likely to get their money back. It's just too competitive out there. And so what I'm wondering is, if you use cash flow, are there any of the big high-tech companies that would be justified from the standpoint of discounted cash flow and asset ownership, and also just from the standpoint of human mortality, meaning if you make an investment in something, you hope to get the investment paid back in a reasonable period of time so that you can enjoy the fruits of it before you pass on. Are there any companies that are justified from that standpoint? And if there aren't, then what's going on is speculation, which everybody seems to know anyway. And then people should be talking about what's the exit strategy. And I hear very little about that from the investment experts out there in the world. And so I guess my question is two-part. One is, what's the right level of cash flow, and are any big companies out there really good value from that standpoint? And number two, why don't we hear more from investment experts like mutual fund managers and others about what the exit strategy is if what we're really doing is speculating anyway? And that's all of my questions, so I'll
Daniel
take
Goodwin, Richard Babson.
Well, you have, in terms of discounted cash flow, it can be very difficult with some of these dot-coms who aren't earning any money at all. It's one of the reasons why we like companies that have earnings as well as expanding margins. It's one of the reasons why we like a company like AOL as opposed to a company like Amazon. AOL, of course, merging with Time Warner, you do have the Internet, and the Internet is essentially what I would call two tin cans and a string. Why is somebody going to listen? Well, the reason that they're going to listen is because of the content. And AOL merging together with Time Warner gives it that type of leveraged content. In the e-tailing sector, you do have people competing on price. And when you have people competing on price, somebody else is always going to come in and be able to offer it at a lower price, and you're going to have pressures on your margins. There have been pressures on margins generally throughout the industrial sector, again because of the Internet working with suppliers for inputs. And it's sort of interesting that when you talk about inflation and the fears about inflation is a double-edged sword. It's one person's price increases another company's profit margin.
Alan Sinai, do you want to take a crack at that general question from Dan?
Well, on companies, I'm really not able to comment on a company's exit strategy on the speculative stocks and the momentum and day trading activity. There's no reason why anybody's going to instruct those people on the exit strategy. That's a dicey game, and it's okay for people to play it. They just have to realize there are...
You can lose it all.
You can lose it. It's a high-risk game, and I think I have a concern if people are doing this for the first time ever, not really being aware that markets go up. Most time the equity market goes up on average over years. We know the numbers, 11% a year, the main averages. But there are times of fundamental economic issues that markets do go down. And the exit strategy, unfortunately, we're seeing some of that in the dynamics of the market. It's margin calls, and I think that's more individuals than anybody else.
Stand by, Alan Sinai, 1-800-423-8255. Joins the conversation on The Connection. Ian is on the line.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Welcome, Ian. Good.
I just had maybe a comment and a question. I saw last week where Alan Greenspan was up on the Hill again and being questioned by, and I forget who it was, but one of the gentlemen asked him why he was trying to whipsaw the markets, and as usual, he claimed that they're not trying to whipsaw the markets, but I guess my comment is, whereas they continue to say that they're in a tightening regimen right now. Isn't that slightly disingenuous to say that they're not trying to do that? And you know, he himself fully knows what the Fed's going to do to the markets by continuing to say they're in a tightening bias. If there's any inflation at all, of course, you get higher inflation. Everybody knows what they're going to do next time.
Well, the chairman is making a very technical and subtle distinction, which is almost lost in the semantics. He's saying that on just movements up and down in stock prices alone, the Fed will not change policy. But he's also said we have imbalances from their point of view, one of which is a boom. Another is a risk of higher inflation. The data Friday told us we do have higher inflation cooking, and the Fed has to control that. And part of the cause of that is the stock market. So out of one side of his mouth, he says we will not react and actually move rates up or down just because markets go up or down. But at the same time, he says we're watching the markets because they do contribute to the excesses. And I think, you know, you can really, if you can understand what he's saying, you can grant him that he can say both those things at the same time.
Go ahead.
Bottom line, the consumption is too strong. And since the stock market's had a major effect on consumption being strong, yes, the Fed is probably okay with the stock market going down if it leads to falling consumption and doesn't really tell us that the economy is going to collapse totally. And yes, in that sense, they're trying to get the stock market.
We've been talking about higher interest rates for a long time and looking at the Fed funds rate maybe going to 7% by the end of the year. Some of this is not new information, and it never ceases to surprise me that some particular statistic can come out like on Friday where suddenly the market reacts when it's been known and a known quantity out there in the longer term for quite some time.
Richard Babson, stand by. You're listening to The Connection. Alan Sinai in New York, you credit basically this fear of inflation. Not everybody does. I mean, what's the proof?
Well, from the point of view of the Fed, the inflation rate's far too high. And it's been creeping up over the past year, and the fundamentals of inflation say it should be higher. We have a lot of stuff to keep going on to keep inflation down, like technology and productivity, but the data actually told us that inflation was getting out of hand last week, and the economy's still booming. And by out of hand, it's important to understand what the Fed is targeting. They're targeting about a 2% rate of inflation. Inflation is moving higher, and it is now, depending on how you measure it, running at 2.5% to 3%. So, Richard's right. We've all known that the Fed's going to keep raising interest rates. But what wasn't known is that inflation would show up so badly. And all that does is say, well, maybe even 7% is too low. They might have to raise rates even higher.
1-800-423-8255 is our rate and phone number. Peter is on the line.
Good morning.
Hello, Peter. Welcome.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the issue of barriers to entry in the Internet markets. One of the things that's always led me to shy away from stocks like Amazon.com is the sense that they really don't have any way to protect themselves against Barnes & Noble, let's say, or, you know, what makes somebody want to end up with drugstore.com versus CVS.com. And when you look at the other kinds of stocks in these markets that people seem more happy about, the Intels and the Ciscos, they have established positions. They have large technologies, or the telecommunications stocks, the AT&Ts or Lucents or whatever. Those are just not stocks that are going to get knocked down because some other competitor puts up another website and suddenly starts undercutting them. And I've been puzzled as to why investors were so enthusiastic about stocks like Amazon, who didn't seem to really have any substantial position that would protect them against competitors.
Peter, people have talked about this, that there's, the margins in e-tailing are very low and very vulnerable.
Very razor thin. What they've done is tried to grab market share, and there is no real estate in the Internet. You don't have, the corner city block that you can monopolize. A lot of people have used their sort of branding and managing the brand as a way of creating advertising for themselves. But you had some of the same questions that you're talking about in terms of valuations come up with Walmart. And Walmart, for instance, has pursued a very successful strategy of being one of the first people in a local community where there may only have been room for one store, and they were the first to open up. And right now they're actually moving out onto the web, and if you are interested in something like e-tailing, I'd be more inclined to move in that particular direction.
1-800-423-TALK is our phone. George is on the line.
Yes, it's George Kinder here, and I'm concerned that with all the comments about the market being a sport, the market really is not a sport for most people, and it shouldn't be a sport. It's something terribly serious in their lives, and the question of how to play this market, I think, is not a question of a 2-year phenomena or just today. How do we play it today? Market, how we as consumers relate to the stock market, it should be about what do we want out of our life, first of all, and then we need to create a disciplined plan of saving and investing to get there. And then if you're young, you should be buying these dips very gently, and if you're older and in retirement, you should be slowly selling, I think, the heights of the market. But I fear that so much we react to panic, either with the automatic buying that has been happening in recent years or with fearful selling. And the market's really about something much more serious for most people in their lives.
Richard Babson, can you improve on that sermon?
Well, it's definitely about making dreams come true. We've said over time, and we've been at the business, the family has since 1904, that buying and holding good quality securities over time is one of the best ways to amass wealth. And what you're talking about is entirely correct, that it's not to be looked at as a sport, or if it is to be looked at as a sport, it's the same idea, I think, of looking at going to a casino as entertainment.
Alan Sinai, keep us sober and safe through this day. What's the key word?
Well, longer run, we'll be fine. But we have
in the long run, we're all dead. You mean?
Well,
volatility. We'll see volatility.
I don't mean that long, Chris. while we're alive, we'll be fine. We'll get through this. It's a severe correction. It's cyclical, and the U.S. stock market isn't going to return what it did before. And the investors should be careful. And I think, though, I would stress the new world. will emerge again as a place to invest, but not the no-earnings, fly-by-night companies with flimsy financing. So even investing in that has to be done with care.
Alan Sinai, thank you enormously for joining us. Thank you, Richard Babson, too. Dave Kansas, John Spooner, Ken Huebner, all the callers and listeners. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Relax the Back, offering new ways to sit and sleep with zero gravity and massaging recliners, ergonomic office chairs, and Tempur-Pedic sleep systems. 800-